Welcome to Grid Talk. My name is George Howson, and today I'm bringing you a fireside interview with one of the co-authors of New York Times best-selling book, The Formula, Joshua Robinson. Joshua, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, really glad to have you on. So I've been reading this book for the last few weeks or so. I have really, really enjoyed it. But how would you kind of summarize the book? What's it about? What kind of topics does it cover? Because it's very wide-reaching. I was really impressed at the scale of kind of the time period and also the topics on offer there.
Yeah, well, it's really, you know, the story of the rise, fall, and kind of reinvention of Formula One. You know, this is a sport that has a long history dating back to 1950 and some manufacturers even before then. But what it does is, you know, F1 was one thing for the longest time, you know, and reached this first peak in the 80s and early 90s. And I'm thinking about the Prost Senna era. But in the, you know, I think with the Schumacher era, it kind of declined in popularity. And there was a point where it seemed like it might just go away. What's happened in the last 5-6 years, though, is really incredible through Drive to Survive and many other things. But really in the Liberty era, we've seen a comeback that is kind of reaching new heights for Formula One. And so we wanted to tell that story and explain to people who might be new to the sport, who might think they know the arcs of this sport, how all of this ties together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've followed Formula One for a very long time now, most of my life, and I've definitely learned a few things through this. I mean, you kind of touched on it there, like how close the sport was to, you know, ceasing to exist in the late 2000s. I mean, that was probably the most fascinating chapter for me, really, kind of covering that and the whole Spygate scandal and everything, because a lot of newer fans, like you mentioned, Drive to Survive there has increased the sport, you know, massively in terms of popularity. A lot of fans now would have no idea that happened barely 10 years ago.
No, exactly. You know, how close this sport went to just imploding. It was in total crisis. The promoters were at war with the manufacturers, who were at war with the commercial rights holders. All of those things were happening at once. And in 2009, as you say, the culmination of two scandals back-to-back, Crashgate and Spygate, nearly caused the sport to eat itself. No one was pulling in the same direction. And there was really starting to be no point in this. Who was gaining anything, except maybe Bernie Eccleston?
That was one constant for about 30, 40 years. Bernie Eccleston is always gaining something.
The house always wins.
Exactly. And he bought the house and he kept it for a very long time. Yeah. So, I mean, what kind of prompted you and Jonathan to, you know, focus on Formula One? Because I looked up the history. You guys have co-authored two books previously, both so focused around football/soccer, if you're American persuasion. And what kind of prompted you to write a book about Formula One?
So Jonathan Clegg and I have, as you say, written two books together before this one. Our first was the story of the Premier League and how the English Premier League took over the world. And the second was about the Cristiano Ronaldo, Lionel Messi era of global football. The same approach, but really looking at how those two guys changed the game, changed the business of sports, and really changed the nature of global celebrity. So for us, it was the same approach on all of these books. And we thought, this was in 2021, after I went to the first Miami Grand Prix, I remember being in the airport and ringing John and saying, I think this is the next book for us. Again, telling the story of that intersection of sports, money, global television, you know, major brands, major investors, all of those things combined to make a pretty exciting cocktail to tell a story about.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot on offer. Even these days, there's a lot going on in Formula One, obviously, and there's more eyeballs on it than ever before. So yeah, it's definitely a good time for that.
We also realized that, you know, because so many new people were coming to the sport and, you know, having watched Drive to Survive, you could watch Drive to Survive and not know the name Bernie Eccleston. You could watch Drive to Survive and maybe not even know the name Michael Schumacher. That if it happened before 2017 or 18, it's almost like it didn't happen at all. So we wanted to fill all that in for newer people and for people who maybe had watched all of that and not realized the connections between, you know, what was happening in the 60s and 70s and how what's happening now. All of these things were tied together, and that same spirit of reinvention really runs through the whole sport.
Yeah, absolutely. It's constantly evolving. I mean, even from when, you know, I first started watching Formula One around the same time that Hamilton came into the sport, you know, it is a completely different animal compared to what it was even then, you know, 15, 20 years ago. It seemed like it was just kind of something that happened in all these far-flung exotic places around the world, and there wasn't anything. I mean, like things like how accessible things are with like Twitter and social media and stuff like that never ever would have happened in Bernie's days. It just wasn't even a suggestion of a conversation. Now you can watch all the highlights of races on YouTube, and it just feels like a completely evolved and different sport.
Well, Lewis Hamilton loves to tell the story of meeting Bernie and Bernie handing him a stack of cease and desist letters because Hamilton had been posting photos on Instagram from inside the paddock. And he said, actually, no, those belong to F1. Bernie was such a control freak in that way. He thought that every representation, every image of Formula One belonged to the commercial rights holder. And loosening that up has really made it infinitely more accessible.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a coincidence that it's become as popular as it is these days. What would you say was the biggest surprise when you were doing your research? I mean, for me, one of the biggest surprises, I mean, obviously we spoke a lot about Eccleston, but the surprise for me was how much of a organized mess, if that is such a thing, that the ownership model was for so long. It seemed like a overly complicated web of organizations and people being involved. And that was probably the point, just so that, you know, Bernie
exactly.
could be at the top. Yeah.
Exactly. That's exactly how Eccleston liked it. The network of relationships and contracts and agreements and historical promises, all of that was only kept inside Bernie's head. It wasn't written down. He says he hates contracts. You know, an agreement was only as good as a handshake with Bernie. And so all of those things kind of kept the sport going for 40 years in, you know, with a sole purpose, really, of enriching Bernie. You know, lots of people didn't like him. Lots of people were constantly suing him, it seemed like. So, you know, once CVC came in, and that's the private equity firm that bought a large part of it in 2006, you know, their purpose was to tidy up the business and bring it into the 21st century as a modern business that could properly sell sponsorship, properly sell television rights, and kind of push the old used car dealer model that Eccleston had stuck to for so long a little bit to the side.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing, isn't it? With him and Mosley, you know, they were chalk and cheese, really, but they work very well together, mostly on the aristocratic and legal side of things. Bernie is the wheeler dealer, which I'm sure that's probably a tag that he absolutely hates, but deep down, that's one of the terms you could definitely associate it with. But yeah, so sorry, just a sec. So would you say that Spygate was the biggest kind of scandal that, because there's a lot of different scandals that are kind of covered here. Liegate, Spygate, a few other ones in between, some of the championship battles between Prost and Senna, but the Spygate one in particular, I think that's one that's been reported on so much at the time that it's kind of hard to get all the information into one place, but you've managed to do it really well here.
Oh, thank you. Well, Spygate is really an insane kind of scandal that goes far beyond what the action on the track. It's really, I mean, it's even barely a sports scandal. It's industrial espionage, and you have to understand that, you know, the idea of someone selling trade secrets from Ferrari or giving them away to someone for the advantage of a competitor who wasn't just a racing competitor, but also, you know, a constructor competitor in terms of actually making cars that are sold to the public, you know, with F1 as their chief marketing tool. That is absolutely massive. And there have been spygates in other sports, and I'm thinking of the one in the NFL involving the New England Patriots. Those actually happened on the same day. They were revealed on the same day, which blew my mind when we realized this. But you look at the fine that was applied in the NFL Spygate, and it was under $10 million. The fine in F1 Spygate was $100 million. It is the largest fine ever applied in sports before or since, and tells you just how seriously they took it.
Yeah, that is a manic story. And again, people who have, you know, only been in Formula One or interested in Formula One for a relatively short period of time won't even know it happened. It's ancient history almost to people like that.
And it was an existential threat to the sport. If you couldn't believe what was happening on the track, that kind of broke the fundamental agreement between, you know, the sports promoters and the organizers of it and the public. You have to be able to trust what you're seeing, that what you're seeing is real. And once that's broken, audiences fell away. There's no point in watching it at that point. You know, so, and when you have a team like McLaren that, you know, could have been irreparably damaged by a $100 million fine and threatens to go away, then you're tearing at the very fabric of the sport.
Yeah, it was a real balancing act between, you know, making sure that McLaren were punished and not accidentally destroying one of the biggest assets. Because aside from Ferrari, they were just, you know, they were the biggest team around in F1 with the most history and definitely success at that time at the front of the circuit.
And that's exactly right.
Yeah, it was a strange old time. It was a strange, very strange old time to be a McLaren fan like myself as well. I was like, my goodness, what have my team done? Like, and it was something that got mentioned, I think, in that chapter too, where it was like, well, all the teams copy from each other. It's just what they do. They try and replicate what works and try and improve on what they've got. But yeah, literally photocopying was
the 700-page manual for that year's Ferrari you can't really be taking that away and giving it to McLaren. But as you say, you know, the culture of copying and imitation is part of the fabric of F1. And even now, you know, probably the greatest designer of all time, Adrian Newey at Red Bull, you'll see him on a Sunday walking the grid, headset on, you know, pencil behind his ear or pencil in his hand with a notebook, walking the grid, looking at the other cars and making little notes to himself because it's there. It's there for everyone to see. So he might as well. And, you know, no one's eye is more finely trained than Adrian Newey's. So he's going to know what all of the little nooks and crannies on a car mean and how they impact performance.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned Adrian Newey. He's a guy who's been in the news a lot recently, obviously leaving Red Bull. I mean, obviously, it's all speculation. It's just something that we've been speaking about quite a bit on the show. But what do you think is next for him? Where do you think he's going to go?
So I was in Miami this past weekend, and a lot of pretty heavy hints were dropped, including from Lewis Hamilton himself, that Ferrari is the place that makes the most sense as a landing spot for Adrian Newey. He can write his ticket in F1 right now. Ferrari, we know, is spending like there's no tomorrow. And that is the place where he can have an immediate impact that shows ambition and that personally, for him, I think, means a lot. If you've spent a lifetime in F1, I think at some point you want to wear the red overalls. You want to wear that suit and be part of the Scuderia because that is F1 history.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And it's going to be an interesting future there as well. I mean, I think Newey has said on a number of occasions, his two biggest regrets in F1, or the two things that he's not done that he wants to do is, you know, be the designer for Ferrari and work with Lewis Hamilton. Well, he can do both of those next year if he wants.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah, very interesting times with him. I mean, we've obviously, a lot of people get covered in this book. Some people that are still working in F1, like Adrian Newey. But who are the mavericks that you wanted to highlight? I mean, there's obviously a lot in here. Christian Horner, Toto Wolff. I find it really interesting to read about those guys. But who are the other mavericks that you want to highlight, really, that are still in F1 to this day?
I think you can't tell the story of F1 and F1 design without coming back to really the guy who started it all, which is Colin Chapman. He was the maverick designer at Lotus for many years and really the father of ground effects in F1. No one did more single-handedly to advance the science of making a car go fast while sticking it to the ground. And I remember talking to Mario Andretti about driving one of the Lotuses in the 70s for the first time. And he said, it was like it was painted to the road. You can just push it so hard and the thing is not going to spin off. You don't have to lift off. It was crazy, he said. And, you know, understanding that level of aerodynamics can actually help you go quicker in the corners, pick up more speed on the straights and keep the car on the road. I mean, that is the whole name of the game.
Absolutely. And yeah, so some of those cars definitely did that. Absolutely. They were pioneers of ground effect, like you say, very rightly there. Very interesting time for the sport. When would you say is your favorite era, though, in F1? If you have to pick one era from the past, I mean, it could be today, but what would you say is your favorite era if you had to pick one?
So I might not sound like it, but I did grow up in England in the 80s and 90s. And I still remember to this day, I became a very big Damon Hill fan. So had a big affinity for Williams in those days. And remember actually getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to watch Damon win in Suzuka in 1996, which was just an incredible time. And I would, you know, I always look back at that for me being the peak of the F1 era.
Interesting. And I'll be honest, that was not the answer I was expecting, but I do see that. Yeah, no.
I had grown up with, you know, watching Senna and Prost and, you know, Damon had a special place in my heart. And yeah, 96 was a great time, great season, because that went right to the wire with Jacques Villeneuve.
It did. Yeah, Villeneuve in his debut season that year. I think a wheel fell off in the last race for him.
I think that has it. Yeah. Yep.
It was, yeah, unfortunate. But you got your guys' championship the following year. I do know what you mean, though. Like, it's a bit before my time, but Williams back then, I mean, Williams is another team, and obviously Frank Williams is another person covered in this as well. That era where Williams were just putting out some incredible F1 cars in the 90s for, I think, I don't know who said it. It might have been Martin Brundle, but somebody said that Williams started as a small team. They didn't have much success. They stayed a small team, but then they had a lot of success. They were still a small team even when they were winning world championships. And that's something that, in a sense, I think is kind of missing today.
Yeah. Well, and part of that is because it was all so tied up in the person of Frank Williams. He was able to delegate in many ways, but it was still his name on the car. And that's how he kept it. And, you know, those Williams cars of the 90s, and, you know, credit to people like Patrick Head, those were so technologically advanced that there came a point where they had mastered sort of many of the like computer driven aspects of the car. So things like active suspension, and it was so advanced the car, you know, almost drove itself. And all you needed was someone big enough and brave enough to sit in there and hammer the accelerator. That turned out to be Nigel Mansell. You know, I don't think anyone looks back on Nigel Mansell as a, you know, particularly gifted driver, but he was brave and he knew how to handle that car. And he was strong enough to turn the wheel and keep it on the road. But, you know, no one ever looked at him in the same class as Senna or Prost, but they won.
Yeah, he was very much a Nearly man for a very long time. And you rightfully say, yeah, he definitely had the bravery. There's a reason why they called him Il Leone at Ferrari when he was there. He was definitely a very brave and courageous driver. So yeah, this book obviously covers a lot about the history of F1, about the different eras and how, you know, what happened before has shaped what we see today. What do you think, it's a difficult question, I appreciate this, but what do you think is the next kind of step for F1? Like what is on the horizon? What do you see happening 5-10 years in the future? Because we've got some more manufacturers coming back in. We've got Audi coming back in. Sorry, coming into F1 for the first time, actually. Honda coming back in. Ford coming back in. It is exciting with these regulation changes that are coming up.
It is. And it's such a difficult question that I think even F1 doesn't know the answer. You have all these manufacturers coming back in. You have a lot of money pouring back into the sport. But, you know, so much of this is built on the foundations of the drive to survive and sort of related products, you know, that kind of fan base coming in, people who might be new to the sport. And this is where they have to be very careful, because you have a lot of people who can genuinely call themselves F1 fans now, but don't necessarily watch the races. You don't need to anymore. You can engage with F1 in so many interesting ways and so many very committed ways that don't involve actually watching for 2 hours on a Sunday, which to some people is the most boring part. But, you know everything about the drivers. You follow them on Instagram. You watch Drive to Survive. You buy the $150 baseball cap. All of these things can make you an F1 fan, but don't require you to consume the core product. And so that's what F1 needs to figure out going forward. How do you keep those people involved? Do you need them to watch the races, or are you sort of pushing out a number of different products at this point? It's not just the racing. You're also selling a lifestyle. You're selling all these related entertainment products. You know, the competition for eyeballs is so fierce today that you kind of have to play on many fronts. And this is the conclusion we draw in the book, that F1 has kind of become a post-sport sport. You can watch highlights, you can engage with the drivers, you can engage with the teams without having to sit there for 2 hours on a Sunday watching cars go around. So as F1 figures out what the future looks like, where you have these manufacturers coming in and getting involved in the core racing, you know, what are you also doing to keep those differently committed fans involved as well, you know, and possibly in a post-Drive to Survive world where, you know, we're heading to season 6. This thing's not going to be around forever. We know there's the Apple Brad Pitt movie that'll be out, I think, next summer, 2025. So that'll be a big kind of tentpole at one point. But, you know, they need to keep figuring out new ways to keep the interest alive, bring in new fans, and build on what they've done. Right now, I think they're very much in a mode of, let's consolidate the gains, because the gains have been so crazy over the past 5 years, and figure out how to do the next thing properly.
Fair enough. Yeah, no, that's it. That's the thing, isn't it? They've got so much going for them. I mean, things like just going on YouTube after the race and seeing in the coming days, seeing things like, oh, top 10 onboards, top 10 radios and stuff like that. You could, yeah, like you said, you can watch the race without actually really having to watch it, or you can, you know, be a part of F1 without actually, you know, sitting down and watching the race for 2 hours. It's definitely changed for the better, I think. Absolutely. Yeah. So just past that a little bit. Sorry, I've lost my train of thought. Oh, that was it. Yeah, that was it. So we've seen a rise in series like Formula E, where obviously you've got a lot of, I think pretty much all the circuits are actually street circuits. Formula One has gone in a similar direction as well. A lot more street circuits on the calendar. I mean, things like Miami, Las Vegas. Las Vegas is an out-and-out street circuit. Miami is labeled as a street circuit too. You've got ones like Madrid coming in for Spain as well. Is that what F1, you think, maybe is trying to do without outwardly saying it? Trying to bring the races to the actual city, to the people living there? Because traditionally, you know, as much as I love venues like Spa, Silverstone, they are in the middle of nowhere, like in the middle of a field or the middle of a forest. Do you think F1's trying to really push it in cities to try and get the people involved? Because that's something that Bernie said. I know it was highlighted in this, but Bernie said it about, oh, it was Phoenix. That was it. It might not have been Phoenix, but it was a big city anyway, and it was near a race. And you had no idea that F1 was there, that F1 was in town. It wasn't being pushed. Do you think F1's trying to kind of learn from those mistakes of those days and push it in the cities now, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, I think there's an element of that. I think the street circuits are very appealing, that they really tell you that F1 is in town, because you can't ignore it, you know, road closures and all that. I think they're trying to go where people are. I think we know that the big push into the United States has been a massive part of the strategy for Liberty Media, the American owners of the series, especially after Bernie was so frustrated with America, he was happy to mostly ignore it, especially after the fiasco at Indianapolis. That was kind of the last straw, and 2 years later, they were out. F1 kind of inched back into the US with Austin in 2012. But adding two more races in the US since then, and as they tell you, six in the North American time zone, because you also have Montreal and Mexico City and Brazil. So those six, that's a quarter of the calendar in actually quite friendly time zones for the market they want to conquer most, which is the US. So whether those are street circuits or not, I think it's more about orienting F1 towards those markets. And they talk a lot about balancing the traditional circuits with the newer ones. So, you know, you have a Miami and a Vegas now, but you still have Monza and Monaco and Spa. It's a difficult balance to strike. And I think we know which way Liberty leans a little bit, because those conversations with Monaco, for instance, around renewal, they went in there and actually threatened to the Prince of Monaco, we don't need it necessarily. We could leave. And so the sweetheart deal that Monaco had for many, many years with Bernie ended up costing them a little more money than it had previously. But I think we're at a stage where the calendar is now 24 races. It can't go higher than that. The race, the drivers, the teams have all said 24 really is the max, because otherwise it stretches the staff too much. They all finish the season absolutely on their knees. But what we might see is some rotation within that calendar. So this is just an example, not something that is definitely happening. But for instance, you could rotate Zandvoort and Belgium, where you've got Spa 1 year in that spot and then Zandvoort the next. So I think we may see some arrangements like that in the near future, but it's not going over 24. And then, you know, as they continue to tweak the recipe for how to build a calendar, we'll certainly see races like Vegas sticking around, because that is one where not only they've signed a 10-year agreement, or Miami, it's up to 15, but F1 is the promoter in Vegas, and they definitely want to keep those in place.
Yeah, it's a difficult balancing act, like you say. It was actually Indianapolis, I just remembered, that was the one that Bernie was going around like, There's no indication there's a Formula One race on here, which I personally loved F1 going to Indianapolis, but yes, it ended up in F1 leaving in disgrace. So simple as that. It was, yep. Again, one that the Canes and the ones that one that got into F1 because of Drive to Survive will never know. That 2005 F1 race, that was another one of the darkest days for F1.
Absolutely. That was the day where only six cars went round the entire race because of a tire fiasco. They were the ones on Michelin tires. And actually, Schumacher won that day for Ferrari. And the team principal that day, who said, this is not how we want to win, is now the CEO of Formula One, Stefano Domenicali.
Yeah, oh, very, very good point. Yes, he was. Absolutely. It was, yeah, not a good one. F1 put some highlights out recently, a 2003 race, but they're not going to do it for 2005, despite what the top comments were saying.
No, I think if they can avoid bringing that to the attention of the newer fans, they're going to.
Absolutely, yeah. What would you say is next for you and Jonathan then, in terms of you? I know, obviously, I think you release the book once every 2-3 years or so. So I'm not rushing you by any means. But have you had any ideas? You don't have to say, obviously, but have you had any ideas? Do you think you keep it in F1, or do you think you'd move to a different sport?
Well, we have pretty busy day jobs. John is sports editor of the Wall Street Journal, and I'm a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, writing about sports. So we have those to keep us busy, but we're definitely thinking about what the next book will be. I don't think it'll be F1, but we're tossing around some ideas at the moment, and I don't think it'll be too long before we're on to the next project.
There are enough exciting times then. But yeah, that's pretty much everything that I was going to ask. Like I said, I really do recommend this New York Times bestseller, and it's absolutely earned that. Very entertaining read. Is there anything that you want to plug while we're here? I mean, I know you've obviously mentioned the Wall Street Journal, but I don't think it needs to be plugged. I think it's got a decent readership. So is there anything else you want to mention?
No, it's you know, if you like kind of the approach and the style of this book, I urge you to go back and check out our soccer books. The Club is the one about the English Premier League and how it took over the world. And then Messi versus Ronaldo is the story of that era, which is definitely coming to a close now.
It is. They are still doing very well in their respective leagues, but they are not in a top European league. But then again, they're both in the late 30s, so it's understandable. It's fair enough. They've had an all right run. Yes, definitely recommend that if you want to get some more inside information on soccer/football. I'm sure they're great reads. I'm probably going to check them out as well, to be honest with you, off the back of this one. But yeah, thank you very much for joining us, Josh. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
And if you guys enjoyed this podcast as well, we'd love it if you could take 5 to leave us a 5-star rating on Spotify or a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. And also, if you're one of the 72% of people who aren't yet subscribed to the YouTube channel, please consider helping us out with a like and a subscribe. And of course, comment as well. Who do you want to get on the next show? I want to bring back these firesides. I want to make them more regular. So we'll definitely be open to suggestions there. We are also available on Amazon Fire, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Music, Verbal, and Pocket Cast. Just search for F1 Grid Talk on all of those, where you can get our big back catalogue of shows. And please consider supporting the channel financially on Patreon as well, so we can get better likes, mics, and recording equipment. And yeah, thank you very much for listening to this Grid Talk podcast Firesides episode presented by Bet Online. See you for the next one. Goodbye.